Hi, I'm Ben McAdams. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center. I'm joined by Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, thanks for coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. Great to be back. And John Dougal on the right.
Hey, wait, we let you come back?
2 weeks in a row.
Where is Natalie?
I know, I miss Natalie.
She's been very busy, and we, of course, always try to find expertly talented centrist-ish individuals to join us. So we're really happy to have you with the experience that you have from being in our state legislature, at our county, leading Salt Lake County, being a member of Congress, and doing really interesting work on public policy still.
She really means having experience on the show.
And you've been here before.
And I can talk politics, yes. Which is what I love to do.
You too.
Well, and there is so much to talk about this week. Summer is over and things are getting heated.
Wait, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
No.
We still got like another week and a half.
I don't know. Labor Day is kind of, well, I guess you've like from the calendar, right? But Labor Day is kind of the official end of summer.
Yeah,
school's
kids are back in school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a lot happening on the global and national stage.
What's catching your attention?
Well, lots happening with vaccines this week. RFK had one of the most contentious congressional hearings I've ever heard. Rare to see a witness dressing down United States senators.
Yeah.
Incredibly inappropriate, but that's getting past the style. Let's get to the substance.
Yeah.
But remember, he's the nephew of a president. So, you know, he's been around this a long time. So,
yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
And the rest of his family had some interesting things to say this week, too.
That's true.
Let's talk about it.
Okay. So I think there were many things that happened in this hearing that are, troubling, can't even come close, I don't think, to really covering my experience of watching chunks of it. But from basic,
in an amazing kind of way.
Misinformation, straight out lies, the complete misleading, denying. Individuals would say, did you say this? And he'd say, no, I've never said that. And it was genuinely like, roll the tape, dude. You just said it. You just said whatever it was that they were calling him out on. And there were so many things to be called out on. But tell me a little bit about your experience of it, John.
So I watched a few minutes of it. My wife told me much more about it. And I saw some stories in the news. First, I have to say that I'm somewhat laughing at the public health industry as they're melting down over this and the loss of faith and trust, as if it started with RFK and as if he initiated it. And, you know, I look at Anthony Fauci and he was part of the demise of the public health, trust in the public health system. And it started long before him. And we've been on this path. I would say that for those that are upset, because I agree with part of what RFK is saying, I think the government in the past has put its thumb in favor of certain activities that were questionable or concerning to people's health. I think that he's wrong and misguided on various other aspects. I think overwhelmingly vaccinations, especially for kids, have been good in the long-term scheme of health. Not good for every kid, but good for the overwhelming majority. And so we have to be able to be smart about when and how to get vaccines and other benefits of modern science for our kids and ourselves. But just to watch this other meltdown, and this is where I come from telling folks, you know, beware that valuable tool in your hands because it becomes a weapon in the hands of your opponent. And I look at folks and go, okay, if you don't trust RFK, the problem isn't RFK. The problem is what you built as a system because a guy like RFK is going to come along.
Yeah.
And you need to understand, you know, you've put too much power in the hands of government.
I think understand is an interesting place where I would stop you, because I do feel like we have a populace that largely has a very hard time understanding basic health information. And the sense, especially, I know, I'm guessing that the complaint that you have about Fauci are things that were said around COVID, probably not any of his earlier work that was, you know, I think instrumental in our understanding of, for example, HIV, other public health work that he had done up until that moment. But that was an instance where we were experiencing something novel, something new. And I do think it's very hard for the general public to come along or to have even been exposed to education that helps them understand how rapidly changing an environment can be with something like a new virus, something that is new to scientists that they're trying to navigate.
I just think Anthony Fauci was too arrogant about thinking that he knew how to deal with this uncertainty.
There were certainly some missteps, and that's going to happen in the time of a pandemic. You know, one of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, the mantra has been choice and that government shouldn't be forcing people to make a choice or taking away options from people. Now, I'm not so sure, you know, you've got to look at the broader public health and herd immunity and different things. But what's interesting to me now is the script is flipped and they are changing the vaccine recommendations so that people who want a vaccine can't get it.
Right.
So the whole thing about choice.
But that's not RFK's fault. That's actually the fault of the various states. The various states like we'll pick New Mexico, anchored it on the CDC recommendations. Because the CDC changed their recommendations. The problem's really with New Mexico, not with the CDC.
I don't think that's quite accurate in the sense that the folks that are on the panel that are now largely anti-vax are advancing these recommendations, or they're actually set to, right? So the meeting of the panel is not convened yet.
We don't think
yet.
You need to get a booster if you're younger than 65.
Right. So, but then it really does prohibit, like, I would like to get vaccinated in this. I'm going to be able to because I have a pre-existing condition that falls on the list. My husband is not in that category, but once. So we have had our choice, our freedom to access this care limited for my own child. I no longer have the choice to do that in this state.
But who's limiting? The federal government. You can still get it per the federal government. They just don't recommend it. And so that falls down to...
Not just yet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
No.
Well, there's a lot of things that are falling down to the states now. Let's talk about Florida.
Well, so this is wild. So Florida basically came out as the first state to end all vaccine mandates for children to attend school, including preventable diseases such as measles, mumps, chickenpox, polio, and hepatitis. And their Surgeon General... This was really also pretty wild to watch. I think the thing that was most concerning for me was as he was interviewed on, as a parent listening to him interviewed on the Sunday shows and being asked, did you model out what hospitals, what communities should be expecting? Like, will they have the capacity that they would need over time to meet the demand that would be caused by basically if we lose herd immunity on these issues? And he said, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Kind of a terrifying answer.
Didn't he say it slightly different than that?
No, he said...
I thought there was like an expletive in there. Well,
I won't attribute that to him, but I will just say that it was really concerning as a person who's worked inside of large health systems. We do not have a ton of extra capacity just floating around in our healthcare system. And to imagine, like from a parental side, what this looks like if you've just had a child in Florida, for example, what this looks like in 3, 4, 5 years is concerning.
So step back, if you will. Why do we need the government doing a mandate? I mean, I think a lot of folks will be rational. They say, okay, I think it makes sense for me to get a vaccination for my kids against measles and polio and so forth. So why do we need the government doing the mandate? So what is it that you think is necessary to attend school? Thou shalt get this vaccination.
I'll just say, but what we're experiencing right now is what you're saying. So rationality for me is that I would like to get my kid who is in fifth grade a COVID vaccine. Okay. I don't have that right anymore in this state. I do not have access to be able to do that in this state. So for me, it says in the interest of public health, we would have the most expansive opportunity for people to get preventive care around these things that we know. I mean, polio, like, I just can't even believe polio is on the list, to be able to get us to a place of herd immunity where we have the chance for people to live their healthiest lives. So I guess if you don't like a mandate saying we must do it, I don't like the mandate saying I can't do it, which is what I'm living in right now in this state.
Okay. And to me, it's like, okay, let the market pitch, you know, the boosters, the vaccines, the whatever it might be. And we can pick and choose what it is we're going to do it and the timing in which we're going to do it. And I think the overwhelming majority of the public will still get their kids vaccinated.
And I just also want to say, talk to your doctors, see what you can do. Like, we're not medical professionals. Talk to if you're lucky enough to still have healthcare in the state, please go talk to your medical provider and get the correct recommendations from them. But go ahead.
Well, I'm going to move to another topic.
I have a lot more trust in my local doctors and healthcare professionals than I do in anybody in D.C.
What I was going to say, though, is it's not about D.C., it's about science. And I don't know that I want 50 states doing randomized control trials about the effectiveness and risks of vaccines. But I do want somebody doing a well-established, scientifically vetted randomized control trial so that we know that there's good science around that. And I think that's the reason for a CDC to make recommendations is based on the science. And that's what I think we are losing is the science aspect of it. But I want to talk now about two things. Well, okay. First of all, I'm going to Chicago in a couple of weeks. Is there anything I should be aware of before I go to Chicago?
Yeah, big time. I mean, what did you see this weekend, Sean?
Trump, I don't know where he's coming from with his Apocalypse Now meme and everything about war against Chicago. You know, to me, that's
so it's a photo of Trump kind of and mimicking the Apocalypse Now movie screen where he says, I love the smell of deportations in the morning. And he said, Chicago's about to find out why it's called the Department of War. Yeah. That's from a United States president talking about sending troops into an American city.
Basically
and going to war with an American city.
It's
like, okay, that's reprehensible from my perspective. There's a certain level of decorum that you should have, even if you think there's crime in Chicago and you're going to go help. That kind of meme is not the way to go about doing it.
I agree with you on the meme. I also agree with you on the policy. This is unconscionable to me on every level. I don't understand how we... I guess I do. I fully understand exactly how we got here. But the fact that the larger Republican apparatus is not as willing to call it out as directly as you are is really troublesome to me.
Yeah. But let's go to the flip side. We've got the Democratic apparatus that was doing Black Lives Matter and defund the police and other things like that, which has fed into this.
And was that calling out the military on an American city? Was that declaring war on
an
American?
That was somewhat.
I just can't both sides.
That was going after the police and saying the police are the problem in so many cases, and we want to defund the police, and we're going to do all sorts of other things, which impacted both actual crime and perception of crime as a result. And so Democrats are paying the price of that. And this is why it's been opportunistic for Republicans, because the Democrats went too far down that narrative.
It's just upping the ante, though. I, as a former mayor, love our men and women in law enforcement, know how much they do. And I've been to so many funerals of police officers. I know what they put on the line, and I'm so grateful for their service. But this is a new level.
And it's not making cities safer.
It's not making cities safer. It's not making police officers safer. It's not doing dignity to the men and women in our National Guard. But you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I'm here with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Well, now, you know, we talk about the federal government and...
And all sorts of things that are bizarre.
And the Constitution. And now let's talk about gun rights. We know Republicans
are going to defend your Second Amendment rights.
To the hilt, right?
Okay.
Right? Is that what's happening?
Yes.
I think something else
is happening. Are there limits?
What are you implying?
So Justice Department this week is talking about taking away Second Amendment rights for transgender Americans.
And the reason this has come up is there was yet another horrific school shooting in Minneapolis. The individual who perpetrated this violence was a trans woman. And now there have been, I think there are just maybe three trans individuals that have been involved in, who have been shooters in these kinds of violence. And I should also say, I do believe that even though the school year just started, we're actually up already over just a troubling number of school shootings that have already occurred. But let's just move past that for the moment to talk about the fact that the Justice Department apparently now thinks that we can do something about guns, but only in the case where they're targeting trans individuals. So the statement came out saying that they were looking at restricting gun ownership. And I think, first of all, this misses the point so dramatically. There is a group of people who perpetrate this kind of violence. It's usually young men. But of course, we're not going to take guns from them. In very rare cases, it's female shooters more than trans individuals. Still not talking about it there. What's your read on this, John?
So I get some that are really excited saying, okay, you know, we're going to call this mental health and we're going to go after this as a mental health crisis. I think that's way beyond the pale. I look and say, you know, you go down that path and, you know, the Democratic administration, the future is going to come down and they're going to draw really broad what it means to be mental health. And they'll start going after lots of other people's Second Amendment rights, taking away their guns and so forth. And there are some people that do fit this limited category where because of their illness, their mental health. Yes.
We need to take
guns away from them in the appropriate manner, going through the appropriate, you know, judicial process for that. But I see a bunch of Republicans that are all excited about this, foolishly thinking this is a good idea when it's absolutely not. We should be, you know, defending essentially everybody's Second Amendment rights. and only take guns from the hands of the very few that are truly adjudicated as mentally ill.
Well, this comes back to the theme of, you know, imagine the tool that is the best tool to advance your agenda. Imagine that same tool in the hands of your worst enemy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is a case, you know, turn it around. What does it mean? You know, I supported when I was in Congress background checks for individuals committed of violent crimes and domestic violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was background checks. But, you know, here we are. And is this a can of worms that the Trump Justice Department wants to open? You know, the common denominator in school shootings and gun violence is not transgender.
That's correct. That's correct.
And even the NRA is against this. And, you know, I'm not a fan of the NRA because I think they're too liberal, but even they're against this.
It's just a bad idea.
I mean,
I think at the end of the day, I will be shocked if this goes forward, but I agree with your assessment of it. This country loves guns more than we love finding solutions, more than we love our children. And that is just proven to me over and over again.
Well, let's move on to another interesting development this week as we see the saga of the Utah independent redistricting and Proposition 4 and the redistricting standards playing out. So there was some updates this week as the parties continue to go before Judge Gibson. The Utah legislature asked for a stay, which she denied, and they have now appealed to the Utah State Supreme Court.
Yes. So now we wait to see what happens here. But I did have to say I was basically on the floor with the headline of the story, which was that lawmakers say they're being harmed by the ruling in this gerrymandering
case. They are being harmed.
I feel like I'm being harmed.
If they're not being harmed, they couldn't appeal it to the Utah Supreme Court. So
I am being harmed by a gerrymandered state where I feel deeply unrepresented, especially at the federal level. But I'll just say, I think on this, it will be interesting to see. Things are going to be moving quickly. They must, given the timelines that have been put in place. But I'm actually really hopeful that we get to a place where we have the opportunity for individuals to pick their representatives and not the other way around.
Yeah. And I think like a lot of Democrats are hopeful that this means there's a Democratic district. And
I saw a story that various Democrats are eyeing this seat and possibly considering a run.
We're not going to talk about that. But but I will just caution the Democrats to say we are opposed to gerrymandering.
That's right.
It is not good for the system to have either party win their election by the way the boundaries are drawn. And what this does is it is the opposite of gerrymandering. It takes the decision away from those politicians that are self-interested, who benefit, and put it in the hands of an independent commission, and it outlaws partisan gerrymandering. So it really gives the decision-making power back to the voter and takes it away from politicians.
And it gives it to a commission that gets to gerrymander how they want to. I would really love to like roll the dice and see arbitrarily, randomly, how the map would be drawn if we did that.
You know, but even under the proposition, that independent commission isn't setting the boundaries. They're delivering them to the legislature that then has to vote them up or down. The legislature can still vote them down and say, we are ignoring the independent commission, and then they can draw their own maps. The caveat is, when they draw their own maps, they have to follow certain standards that were also adopted by Prop 4.
Yeah.
And one of those standards is that you can't divide a city or a county more than is necessary. So you look right now what the legislature did in 2021, dividing the city of Mill Creek into four congressional districts, really for what seems pretty blatantly for the intention of dividing up the Democratic base into four different districts so that they could not come together and elect their own representative. That would be outlawed. So the legislature will still have the prerogative to draw a map. They just can't divide cities and counties more than the population of the district requires.
Well, so that story involved the Supreme Court. And then we also have more news at the Supreme Court. I'm not sure that we've talked about. I think we have.
John Pierce is retiring.
He's retiring.
In December.
Yes. And so now we go back to the process where nominees come forward. They're chosen by the Appellate Court Nominating Commission. And then there were a cadre of folks that came forward in that. And now the final recommendations have come forward to the governor to select the nominee. And they do have something in common. What is it?
They're all men.
Yes,
yes.
I'm so glad you're keeping track of what your people are doing.
Well, the last three appointees were women.
Yes,
the
and
court
we do
is
have
currently
a female majority.
3-2 women versus men on the Supreme Court. It's a five-person court.
Five-person court. So I think it's interesting that out of the nominees that have come forward, it is all men.
I heard a lot of women were not even going to put their name in because they just looked and said, there's no way they're going to go 4-1 female.
I had heard this as well.
And this is just the pool from which the governor can draw from to make his nomination.
That's
right.
Correct.
Nobody's criticizing if the governor were to nominate a man. This is just saying the pool that went forward to him was all men. And
that's correct.
Yeah, maybe there should have been some diversity in there.
Lots of well-qualified individuals.
For sure, definitely.
I think the bigger issue to watch for is not necessarily the gender of the person that gets on the court. It's going to be their judicial leanings or temperament, you know, because the legislature is upset with the court, various courts, but especially the Supreme Court
the
over some past
of
rulings.
Being a separate branch of government.
So therefore, that will be the thing that would be more interesting is going through that confirmation process.
Yeah, that'll be something to watch. Well, you know, I want to hearken back to another topic that was in the news this week, and that is it was announced that Charlie Kirk, right-wing prognosticator,
get around sometimes.
Is doing a college tour through Utah, and this is creating some controversy. I am not a fan of Charlie Kirk. I think he's incredibly divisive, but he is stopping.
I've heard the name, but I don't even know who he is.
I don't listen to any of his stuff, but I know I've seen some of his snippets in that. But he's stopping at Utah State University.
I think it's Utah Valley University and Utah State University. Okay. So here we go. I think back into these kind of conversations or debates around speech on college campuses. I think for me, what I would love to see is for folks to get online, buy out all the tickets and not show up. That sounds like a great way to protest.
We were talking off air, but you know, when you're a speaker to a crowd, if they're cheering you or they're booing you, you're getting energy from the crowd.
Yeah.
If the crowd is silent and they don't respond, that is the worst audience to be a speaker.
You know, when I was in college, I was the president of the College Democrats at the University of Utah.
I believe this about you.
My best friend was the president of the College Republicans. We had a column
this is the liberal Alex Keaton right here.
we had a column that we would write like point, counterpoint, and we would have debates. And I just wonder what has happened to the college tradition of bringing in the most outlandish viewpoint, listening to them, feeling outraged, and then going and debating it with your fellow college students, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I think is missing here. Like, I'm not a fan of Charlie
Kirk.
Oh,
it might hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
I would love to see him come and speak on university campuses in the state of Utah, and I'd love students to attend and be outraged and then a debate. That's what happens at college campuses. And bring in the progressive equivalent and have that debate. That is what college is for, is to be exposed to ideas from across the spectrum and to embrace them or reject them, but to debate them rigorously.
Well, we've said over decades, the best way to fight offensive speech is with more speech.
Yeah.
Engage in more speech.
And again, to the point of the tools that are, you know, your best tool to advance your agenda, imagine that tool in the hands of your worst enemy.
Yeah.
Again, we see liberal speech and the Trump administration cracking down on liberal speech at Columbia University, to Harvard, Stanford, and how outrageous does that feel to us? I would call on Democrats to stand up and Democratic college students to stand up and say, he's welcome here.
Yeah.
And he's welcome to say his, you know, outrageous things, and we are going to then debate it and be outraged.
Happily reject the ideas. I agree with you there. Well, speaking of speech giving, this is a bit of a turn, but can you share a little bit about what you just did the other day?
Yeah, so this week, State Senator Paula Julander, longtime state senator, Democratic, like stalwart, passed away.
Yeah.
And I was honored to speak at her funeral and to give the political life sketch and about her life and service. And what an incredible individual, what an amazing woman who really trailblazed for women, for Democrats, and has such a strong legacy that she's left.
Well, tell us a little bit about some things that stood out to you in her legacy.
So, you know, when she was elected to the Utah State Senate, well, first of all, when she ran for the House of Representatives, she was a long shot candidate running against another impressive candidate, a woman by the name of Olene Walker.
Yeah.
She won in a very narrow election and served in the House of Representatives. She later ran for the State Senate. She was, at the time, there was one woman out of 29 state senators serving in the Utah State Senate. The year that she was elected, we changed that from 1 to 4.
Yeah.
So she was elected along with Karen Hale and Bev Evans, and then Millie Peterson was already in the Senate. So quadrupling the number of women in the state Senate. You know, Paula Julander from the South, she was on Planned Parenthood boards.
Yeah.
So she has a long legacy in fighting for women's rights, women's reproductive health. You know, she also was a single mother for much of her time raising a daughter. She was known to be a fantastic cook. And so she would make pie. She needed a little bit of a side hustle to support herself and her daughter.
Yeah.
So she started baking pies and delivering them to restaurants around the Salt Lake Valley. So if you, you know, I've heard so many people say, oh, those pies from Gourmandise or from Gastronomy or different restaurants, those were her pies.
They
so she would wake up in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, bake these pies, load them into the back of her Mercedes, and go and deliver them to restaurants around town when she took her daughter to school.
Oh, that's amazing. Do you have a quick story?
I served with her. She was just a wonderful lady to serve with. Even though we disagreed politically, we were good friends. It's nice to hear other stories about her life experience.
Well, we're grateful for those who step up to serve and sorry for the loss to our community and to those who loved her.
It was beautiful to see her family and the legacy that she leaves behind. And her husband, Rod, who is a longtime Weber State, Rod Julander, Weber State professor, and she just leaves a wonderful legacy.
Wonderful.
Well, you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. And thank you to our producer, Anthony Scoma. And thank you for listening.